come along with us as we explore the broad world of preservation and the work being done to preserve, interpret, and save our past in a 21st century world. From aquaculture to historic foodways to forensic modeling, we're talking weekly with experts from across the globe. This is your host, Nick Redding. Welcome to PreserveCast. On this week's episode of PreserveCast, we're sitting down with Natalie Henshaw, Director of Historic Trades at the Campaign for Historic Trades. We'll learn all about historic trades apprenticeships, the impact they're having, and how you can get more involved in making sure that trades training happens in your community. All that and more on this special edition of PreserveCast. This is Nick Redding. You're listening to PreserveCast, and I am thrilled to be joined by one of my peers at Preservation Maryland, who actually heads up the Campaign for Historic Trades, the Director of Historic Trades, Natalie Henshaw. And for those longtime listeners of PreserveCast, you'll know that Natalie is one of the few that I trust in handing over the keys to PreserveCast to guest host some trades takeovers. She's done some amazing conversations. In fact, some of our most downloaded episodes came from the mind and the interview skills of Natalie Henshaw. And in addition to being a great guest host of PreserveCast and heading up the Campaign for Historic Trades, which is the National Trades Training Initiative of Preservation Maryland, she also, at the campaign, has spearheaded the effort to register apprenticeships for historic trades, which is no small feat. And we're going to talk about what that all means and why it's a good thing and why anybody who cares about preservation should care about historic trades apprenticeships. But before we get there, just for a reminder, for somebody who has unfortunately missed Natalie's previous episodes, Natalie, where did you grow up and how did you get into this line of work?
Very excited to be here. Thank you, Nick. Well, I'm an Okie, originally from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and have a background in history. So I have my bachelor's and my master's in history. And I had the great fortune to graduate in 2009, which was the best year to find a job. The best. So I had been working at actually a Cherokee casino in the buffet, and that had paid for school. And I was still working there a year after I had graduated, tried to apply all these places. Wasn't getting hired. And I finally got enough feedback that said, you know, we've hired this person, but they were a little bit more qualified than you were. And I was like, well, how do I get more qualified? And I found actually an internship with the National Park Service in preservation. And it was, I think, up in Idaho, and it was going to be repairing sod houses and fences. And I was like, this sounds amazing. I applied and I didn't get it. So I was like, okay, how would I get that job? How would I get qualified to do that? And it was a struggle to find any information about how to get qualified for that. There were very few schools, and most of them were at least 5-state radius away from me. So looking at where I wanted to go with my career, I was like, I guess I have to up and move. So I found Savannah Technical College. It was in Georgia. It's a 2-year program. It was hands-on. And I moved and I went there and I worked my way through school and started all these different pickup jobs and worked with nonprofits and worked with private companies and did an internship at the National Park Service out at Fort Pulaski. Eventually ended up teaching and opening my own business here too. And then I started working with Preservation Maryland.
Yeah. And then she got a call out of the blue and said, what do you think about changing the nature of historic trades training in America? And after she realized I wasn't trying to like punk her or something like that, she realized that this was a cool opportunity. So that has been several years in the making, this whole apprenticeship piece since you started this work. It's core. I mean, maybe take a step back for people listening who aren't familiar. What is the Campaign for Historic Trades? And then we'll talk about how apprenticeships are a big piece of that. But give people like what your elevator pitch for the campaign.
Absolutely. It is a national workforce development initiative to expand and strengthen careers in the historic trades. If you look at any workforce development program, it's to help people find jobs and help employers find people and find the gaps to both of those challenges. So that's what we've been working on, is finding people who want jobs, finding employers who need employees, and see the training needs and how to get that met, essentially.
So it's a big job. I mean, that's there's a lot of different ways that could go.
So
you know, I did an interview with somebody else, and we were talking about how when a challenge is so big, sometimes even an organization that has a little bit of resources behind it and your team now that has grown, it still is, you're talking about just a monumental national challenge. So how does a small but mighty team make outsized impacts with small resources? And apprenticeships are a big piece of that. Before we get into why and how and all that kind of stuff, for someone listening who's like, I don't really understand it, what is an apprenticeship?
Great place to start, because I think there are, it's not clear necessarily, because you have the term apprenticeship overall, which is used colloquially, and it can mean a lot of different things to different people. Ultimately, it really just means on the job training. So somebody who gets one-on-one training with a professional in a job setting. So that's the overarching term. In the United States, we often talk about apprenticeships broadly, but I guess if we're talking about it with the Department of Labor, there's very specific things around it. So the Department of Labor has registered apprenticeship programs, also known as RAPs. And to have a registered apprenticeship program, you have to go through different steps with people from the Department of Labor to make essentially an official occupation. So each of these apprenticeships has 6 major components. Obviously, one is the on-the-job training. You are an employee on the job, and you're receiving a specific set of training. There's an instruction component. It's called related instruction. So you are on the job learning what you need to do your job. But you also need to know the theoretical things. On the job, you learn how to do it, and the related instruction gives you the information to do that job. You're paid, obviously. That's the big part.
That's a good part, too. People like that part.
Yes.
And actually, it's funny. Yeah. We're kind of making light of it, but it's really important because I think a lot of people, for some reason, particularly when a lot of internships were unpaid, and that's uncool.
Yes.
Preservation Maryland pays its interns, but and so does the campaign. But but back in the day, and still a lot of people, those are unpaid. And so I think a lot of people think, oh, man, you know, you got to do this 3-year apprenticeship and you don't get paid during it. But that's not the reality. And so that's an important distinction. We were kind of just kind of making light
yes.
of it, but it is really important.
It's really important. And it's increased wages. So the other component of this is a set out duration. You have to have an apprenticeship for so many number of hours. Usually the minimum is 2,000 hours, which translates to about a year. Some of them even go up to 8,000 hours. So it depends on the occupation. But as you progress through your apprenticeship, your wages increase. And it's set out in a proportion. So as an apprentice going in, you know, I start at this, but I will end up making this amount as I attain skills. So that's a really key component too of the increase of the wages. Another component is the mentorship. So you work one-on-one with somebody who's a qualified journey worker. And you can have only that ratio or 4 journey workers to an apprentice. So you could have 4 journey workers to 1 apprentice. You can never have 1 apprentice to 4 journey workers. Or pardon me, the opposite of what I just said, 4 apprentices to 1 journey worker.
That would be bad.
It's a class then. That's not an apprenticeship. And so this makes sure that you have the necessary supervision and guidance and mentorship to learn the competencies that you are supposed to during your apprenticeship. And then lastly, you come away with a certification. This is issued by the Department of Labor saying that you're a journey worker in this occupation. And it's a recognized credential across the country.
So let me play devil's advocate here.
Okay.
The preservation community, we restore buildings. And we've never had registered apprenticeships. Why does this matter?
Right. So part of that's actually kind of inaccurate. We've had a couple registered apprenticeships before, but they have lapsed because what has been lacking is somebody who is a sponsor that can keep it going through. Registered apprenticeships have to keep being registered each year and keep being used by apprentices. So oftentimes it was one employer who set something up, but once their apprentice was done, they were done. So they do exist and they have existed, but they typically lapse because they're not set out in a format that many people can use. So that's one of our great positions as the campaign, is that we're going to be that sponsor that can keep seeing it through, keep seeing these sponsored and get people connected with them so they don't just kind of peter off into the ether anymore. In terms of the workforce, like, we've studied it with our labor analysis. We haven't had trainings in the past. That's correct. Or like an official training path, an official apprenticeship like this before. But we also know that since the 1960s, we've been saying there is a huge labor shortage in people who know how to do historic trades and restore historic buildings. And, you know, you and I have both seen some of the consequences of people who do the work who don't know how to do the work and what it does to the buildings, or used as a justification to demolish. If they can't find people to restore it, then it gets demolished. So I guess it's a long-winded answer. There have been pieces before. The importance of having it now is that having these as registered occupations has a lot of trickle-down effects that'll help benefit the industry. Having a registered occupation as a business owner is really important. When I founded my business in Savannah, they had no idea what my tax classification was. They put me as a handy person. And then the next year as a remodeler, even though we just worked on historic windows. So I was lumped together with people who redid bathrooms, which is like not really accurate. Then going for liability insurance, it was the same thing. There wasn't quite a classification that worked. So I went with a handy person. And then for workers' comp, we just get rejected all the time because they don't have it set out already. But having an occupation like this through the Registered Apprenticeship Program, we already set out what you're doing proportionally on the time. And once you have that code and you work with an insurer to get that set up, other people can pull from it. So even from the developing more businesses standpoint, those are huge hurdles that we have to growing our business. We could have grown more with those in place, but we take time away to try and get all these things negotiated out. So at the very base of it, there's some of the business ownership that'll allow more people to grow and set up their businesses by having these in place. Secondly, I'll point back to my experience. I was in Oklahoma. There were no training programs anywhere. Couldn't find anything nearby me. I had to move if I wanted to do this. And I had the luxury to be able to move. If somebody else in Tulsa wanted to do it, they don't have the luxury to move necessarily, right? The Registered Apprenticeship Program can be adopted anywhere by anyone. All you need is somebody who is a journey worker. And then we can help get it established. We can help get somebody recruited. We can help see somebody through this training program. And we're hosting that instructional piece online. So even if there isn't a school nearby, we can still deliver the instruction needed for their apprenticeship program and they come away with a certificate. So geographically, it's super important to open this up to a lot more people.
Yeah. And I feel like the biggest picture piece here that all of this kind of builds towards is it creates a workforce capable of continuing to do preservation rehabs, which at this moment, you know, yeah, we're getting stuff done, but you're right. There are times when we can't, or there are situations where, you know, a certified local government says, well, you've got to restore your windows. And they're like, cool, happy to do it. But who on earth do I hire?
Yeah.
There's one person in our county and they said they can get to me in 3 years.
Yes.
Right. And so there are, and that's like where we're at now. If nothing changes in 10 years, it's going to be even worse. So just creating more people capable of doing this is important. Creating pathways so the people who want to do it know how to do it is important. And also, as you said, too, professionalizing it, creating truly sort of a craft and an industry of preservation trades, because right now it's sort of ad hoc. I don't know if this is the right way of explaining it, but sometimes people, when people ask me, I'm like, well, one of the values here is that you'll know what you're getting when you, you hire somebody who has gone through a program yes. like this. Whereas, you know, right now, if you want to hire an electrician, of course, you know what that means. I mean, there's certification, there's even licensing associated with that. But you don't hire somebody who just says, yeah, I've hung out with a bunch of electricians and I'm really good at it.
Yeah.
And that's not exactly as, it's not quite that dire with preservation, but sometimes it is, right? Or it's like, I've yeah. been with people who did windows, so I know windows. And yeah. it's challenging knowing who to hire and who not to hire. And so over time, this should mm-hmm. make that process simpler for people hiring and wanting to make sure that they can maintain a certain level of quality. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Yes. We in our business have identified people, or we've gone after work to do some repairs on something where somebody knew how to do it. And, you know, we find window sash that were rebuilt with deck screws. And we're like, well, that's not somebody who knows how to rebuild a wooden sash. And there's a lot of consequences of doing stuff like that. It's not just, oh, that's the cheap way to do it. That can rot out your window over time. That's not how it's supposed to be built for so many reasons. But somebody who's hiring them, like you said, they wouldn't know. And why would they? You know, they don't know necessarily how to build a sash window. They trust somebody who says they do, but there's no credentialing to guarantee that. So, you know, in that scenario, if that person had their window apprenticeship credentialing, and they did that, there'd be some recourse to go back and fix it, or there'd be a way to check that that was the proper way to do it. So it's not a foolproof, you know, you can still get the same with an electrician who technically passes and still does wrong work, but there's a lot more recourse in those scenarios where we don't have that now.
Let's take a quick break, come back, and then talk about what the future holds when it comes to apprenticeships and where this is all headed and the ones that have been recently registered. And we'll talk about where this actually, where the rubber hit the road, so to speak, on historic preservation and apprenticeships. And we'll do that right here on PreserveCast. Every Monday, PreserveCast brings you stories from around the world that make the case for the value, relevance, and importance of history in our lives. And we can't do it without our sponsors and listeners. As we approach our 300th episode, we want to thank you for tuning in each week. Interested in sponsoring an episode or simply supporting the operations that make this possible? I ask you, please visit preservecast.org/donate to help us tell more important stories about the importance of history to all of us. This is Nick Redding. You're listening to PreserveCast, talking with Natalie Henshaw, Director of Historic Trades at the Campaign for Historic Trades. You can find them at historictrades.org. And we were talking about why apprenticeship matters, what apprenticeships are, how this could potentially be a game changer for historic preservation. And I mentioned up front, we just recently, the campaign this is in last year, way back in 2023, registered several historic trades. So why don't you give listeners a sense for what happened, and then we'll talk about what that means. But which were the ones that were registered, and what did it take to get there?
Right. So we have a registered group program, which means we have multiple occupations in our program. And we did three occupations: deconstruction technician, historic window technician, and preservation carpenter. And yeah, it was like a 3-year process to get this all together. On like the essence of apprenticeships is actually very simple, and what needs to be outlined can be very simple. But making all the pieces fit together was difficult, because you want to be sure to integrate the needs of the employers. Apprenticeships, by their nature, are all employer defined. What I did first was going to the Department of Labor, talking about what we wanted to do. The first thing they wanted to see was position descriptions. They wanted to see, what are these jobs that people are hiring and need to be hired? If those don't exist, we're not going to register an apprenticeship in it. Because the whole point is that you are hired for that job and trained up to be a journey worker in that job. So if that job doesn't exist, there's no apprenticeship need. And I think previously, a lot of training programs had designed for what they think there should be, not necessarily what the economic basis of it was. And I think that doesn't make too much sense until you see the reverse of the descriptions. You know, once you compare a training plan necessarily to a job description. And we had first tried preservation technician, and when they had seen the job descriptions, they looked at it, they're like, this actually looks more like a preservation carpenter. And I was like, well, yeah, but the primary duties actually have to do with carpentry. So we had to do a lot of back and forth like that, going back to the drawing board, reframing things, trying to get it phrased in a way that was adaptable to different scenarios. Because a preservation carpenter can work on a log, construct a building. They can work on a timber frame barn. They can work on, you know, shingle siding. They can work on roof trusses. So there is, it was kind of difficult to figure out what is a training plan that incorporates all of that and makes it flexible so that somebody in Oregon can use it and somebody in Georgia and somebody in Maryland can use it. Deconstruction technician, we worked with Repurposed Savannah, who had already been interested. So that's probably also like a big overarching takeaway is that we worked with partners who were already vested, ready, interested, and had some of the legwork already set out that we could pull from. They could already hire. They had an interest. They already had a training plan. They had a job description ready to go. So we worked with them on that registration process. And then same with the historic window technician. We worked with the Window Preservation Alliance. Oh my gosh, my words all jumbled. The Window Preservation Alliance is a 501c6 trades association, obviously dedicated to window preservation. It's a really strong group with a lot of good business owners who know the issues, know the needs, and understand designing for the job descriptions. So they already had window technician position descriptions ready to go that we were able to pull from. And the whole training plan of the apprenticeship is to essentially design a plan that can take somebody from zero to that journey worker technician level. Yeah. And then preservation carpenter, like I said, we started out with technician and we worked pretty closely with the Historic Preservation Training Center on what they would need for a preservation carpenter, because they are ready to hire right away in that position. So in addition to designing the plans, we went back and forth with the Department of Labor, got all that approved, had the support of these different employers and organizations. And then we had to start getting employer paperwork. So like I said, initially, this is employment-based. We couldn't just register it and have no jobs. They wanted to see commitment from employers who were ready to go, who said, yes, I agree with this training program. And yes, I am ready to hire an apprentice if this comes on board. So we were able to get a few different employers on board, ready to go with this and submit those as well. And then we went to Maryland's apprenticeship committee hearing. You were there. You saw
it. I was there. I was there for all of it. It was, yes, it was one for the history books.
Yes. Maryland is very intense with it. And I think in a good way. They have the apprenticeship committee made up of employer representatives and employee representatives, as well as agents from the Department of Labor. And they review the different plans, provide their questions, perspectives, and edits, and then approve or not approve a plan. And we definitely got a lot of questions.
Yeah, we're laughing about it, but it was really thorough. And it was sort of heartening to see how serious they take all of this. Mm-hmm. They don't just sort of rubber stamp the concept of apprenticeships. They really kind of dive into it.
Yes.
And I think it makes it a better program in the end, because the outcome is that there are really well done apprenticeships. So now that it's done at the Maryland side, what does that mean for somebody who lives in Tulsa?
Yeah. So we have the program approved in Maryland, and the Department of Labor with apprenticeships has different methods. So a state can decide to go by those federal standards, or they can have their own individual office of apprenticeship. Maryland has their own individual office of apprenticeship. So that's who we registered through. And now we have taken it to the federal Department of Labor, and they are reviewing it to become guidelines, federal guidelines for people. Once it's approved by them, it will go out to all of these offices of apprenticeship across the country. So if Oklahoma's Office of Apprenticeship sees this, they can register it in their state and an employer utilize it and hire an apprentice. So it's there ready to go and be activated, essentially, once an employer is ready.
And so preservationists listening, or, you know, a local preservation group or a statewide listening, once that's available, they could also be an advocate for their Department of Labor to do that, right? So
absolutely.
Preservation Oklahoma could say, hey, Oklahoma Department of Labor, this thing's ready to roll. We'd like to see you adopt it. So they can, this is a simple way. I'm asking, actually, is this a simple way for preservation groups to get engaged once that's available?
Yes, absolutely. And I would say the other major component is having those employers on board. Mm-hmm. So they will need an employer ready to go, ready to hire with it and approving of the program. Because again, it's ultimately employment-based. You can't have an apprenticeship without an employer. They have to be a full-time permanent employee.
So apprenticeships are great. We know why. It took a lot of work to get us here. We've registered several. What do you hope the future holds, and where does this go from here?
Right. I guess one thing I forgot earlier about the development of this is that since the 1960s, there's been tons of legwork already in preservation training. There still needed to be a national push to bring this all together, and that's really what I tried to make this into. So all these designs, the reason it took longer is that we tried to consider how can these different programs be a part of it? How can somebody be what's called a pre-apprenticeship and have somebody integrate easily into this with their program? How can somebody provide some of that related instruction? And we have designed it to essentially be that. And so what I really want to see is that any of these training programs that already exist, we can integrate into the process. So I think actually San Antonio is a really good example. They did reach out to me about this. They're very excited for the federal guidelines. They already have training programs in place. So once we get this registered, they can register it in their state, start using it, and we can start working on how to qualify their programs as components already and cobble this together. It's coming from the top down, but it's also very grassroots, which I think is just what preservation has always really been, is the grassroots efforts. So I want to see all these different localities that have these things in place come to us and figure out how the system can work with what they already have and where we can fill in the gaps. And I think that it's going to be slow to start because it's new. We're still building these systems, figuring out these questions. I don't think that everybody's going to sign up right away for it, but you know, this is an option for people looking for training or looking for employees or looking how to like help solve the bigger problem. And hopefully it's just the start of the snowball and it'll get bigger and bigger as we go.
So for people listening who want to learn more, want to get engaged, want to help, what's the simplest way for somebody to take the next step here?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have our website, historictraits.org. We've tried to make this very much a living resource and also a way that you can supply us with some information. So we have a training and education page where you can find these different providers, but also a submission form. So if we're forgetting one, you can submit and tell us. Same with professional networks and same with an opportunities calendar. So if you have a job or a training or a class or a workshop or conference, we have a map for all of that to help find people these different opportunities to get involved. So that's a very simple way that you can just be engaged, help us out, help build this structure out. We also have our newsletter you can sign up for, keep up to date on everything. We also have a monthly drop-in call called Talking Trades, where we can just talk about these different things. So if you have questions, if you're interested, if you're not sure how to get engaged, you can register and join us and talk with other people who are like you. So maybe you'll find somebody to network with about one of these topics beyond us. And we'll also probably have some of these training sessions for the registered apprenticeship program upcoming. So I'd like to have something for employers who want to get on board and have a training session for them, as well as people who want to become apprentices or somebody who wants to start a pre-apprenticeship program. So we haven't established those, but I foresee that happening over the next year of having those specific training sessions for people to get involved and obviously to donate.
So the best place is to head over to historictrades.org. The Talking Trades is a great way if you just want to ask questions to jump on and do something like that. And you can register for the next one there. And it also sounds like we just need to have you back in like 6 to 8 months and give us an update on where we're at, because it's constantly changing. But we wanted to bring this to listeners because it's a big thing. It's a big moment and more to come, but it's a big step for the Campaign for Historic Trades, and one that could resonate across the country. And so excited to have you here to bring that conversation to the listeners. We'll certainly have you back. And who knows, maybe you'll be talking trades sometime soon here on a Trades Takeover, and you'll get to hear Natalie again soon. Thanks so much for joining us today, Natalie.
Yes, thank you, Nick. Happy to be here.
Thanks for listening to PreserveCast. To dig deeper into this episode's story, head over to preservecast.org for show notes and our collection of previous episodes. Don't forget to engage with this podcast by subscribing, commenting, and leaving a review. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at PreserveCast for even more. PreserveCast is currently recorded in Walkersville, Maryland, and sponsored by the 1772 Foundation and powered by Preservation Maryland. Thanks for listening, and keep on preserving.